a couple at a time, and they have a number of pictures, and there's a few videos to show you guys as well, just to get hopefully a little bit of a taste of what they experienced. And now I will say this in advance. Doing this in one service will never capture everything that these guys have experienced. We could probably have one of these guys each take a service for the next several weeks, and that still wouldn't capture it all. Kind of think what I wouldn't have to do was much prep. You guys up for that? That'd be maybe not. Okay. But this is hopefully a springboard for you as a church family to come around these guys as well and embrace them and take them out, hear their story, hear more of what actually they experienced while they were in Kenya. Because what we've tried to do today is kind of put this in a few compartments to talk a little bit about where Temani came from, where things are at present, and also where they're going. And through that, also share a lot of the experiences these guys had while they were there. So I want to invite Chris and Quindle to come up first. And they're going to share some time up here a little bit to tell you a little bit about where Temani has come from through their interactions with some of the guys there.
Actually, I'll let Quindle just start. He's going to just explain where the name Temani came from and sort of some background from that.
Are any of you guys going to do a history of how it started? Nobody's done. Okay, I'm just going to very, very briefly touch on the history of Temani because it is a story in itself. And we don't have time for that. So everything we're going to share this morning is a story in itself. And it's going to be a very, very nutshell, like Dave already said. Temani. Temani means desire. This is the desire of every homeless child to have a home, a family, a mother and a father, a roof over their head, and food in their tummy. And that's what this place gives. And there are very many different circumstances as to how kids end up in this particular facility. And some of you already know those stories, some of the kids that have gone, some of the adults that have been on that, us. We know those different stories and whatever. And there's stories of victory. There's stories that will tear your heart out. But the cool thing is that God has got his hand in it. So it started a few years ago with three guys, James and John, twins, and a friend of theirs that they grew up with, David Sokobi, who happens to be Trofina's cousin. And these guys started with just doing a lunch thing every once a week, going in and feeding these girls that were just taking a lunch to them on, I think it was on a Friday or something like that. And from there, I grew into a desire to start an orphanage. And I won't go into any details on that because that's, like I said, that's a story in itself. To where we are now, 8 years later, they are in a transition. 3 years ago, they bought this property, which you'll see pictures of, countless pictures of. The kids only got to spend half an afternoon there. We got 7 days. What happened? And so 3 years ago, they got to that. They got that property. And for 3 years, they've been wanting to see a wall or a fence put around this to define this space and this land where these kids are going to go. It's roughly 10 acres. And towards the end, that dream became a reality, except for the front section. But somebody else will be talking about that later. So what you're going to hear this morning, we can't present Temani to start off with. We can't present Temani without giving you an understanding of the people that are kind of behind, that are running it, and their vision, their dreams for this. We can't present Temani without the sights. Unfortunately, you may or may not hear the sounds. You definitely will not get the smells, okay? If we could, on this video that you'll see a little bit later, give you a 4D experience, you would get that. But we can't give that to you. You have to go there to find that out for yourself. So thank you for being here today. Thank you for supporting us and sending us out on this trip. And I'll just let Chris start, then I'll come back on, and then the other guys, and then we'll just kind of go through with our different thoughts and everything. And thank you again.
All right, so the part I'm going to speak to is the key, sort of some of the key people in Kenya that we worked with. And the first person there is the guy in the white suit. His name is Nick Sokobi. He's the bishop of the church there. And he was instrumental in driving us around, and he's the heart of what they call New Hope Church. And this picture here is actually the intended church, but we actually met in the basement. But the part about him that I wanted to talk about was just clarity of vision and call. You know, we all would want to have a call in our life where we know this is where God wants us, and if we have that, we can go to that and live our lives 100%. Nick has this call for his church, and so he never worries about how much money he has or whether the church is doing well or it's not, because this is God's calling on his life, and his life is invested. And so the very first thing he did after the church service was drag us to the top and explain the vision for the church service on top of that. And then right away, he wanted us to gather around and hold hands and pray for the church and for the direction that he feels that God was calling for this church. So once again, I was just moved by his absolute confidence in God's faith, or in God's faithfulness to bring this about and use him as an instrument. One of the stories he told was, he said a lot of evangelists will come into Kenya and they'll hold these big seminar things, and lots of people will come to the Lord and they'll think, oh, I'm going to be a pastor. I'm going to settle down here and I'm going to make a church. And he started to laugh. He goes, he wasn't called to be a pastor. He was called to be an evangelist. And so Nick was absolutely convinced that he was called to be a pastor of this church here. And then this is James. He's the man who runs the orphanage. And this, as Quindle explained, this man also has a call. And with these kids, his whole life is 100% invested in these kids. And if you were to ask him about his personal finances or his personal goals, none of it is relevant apart from what he has in mind for these kids. His whole mind is wrapped around where they are right now, making sure they have food, making sure they have schooling, and then the other half of his life is the land that we worked on, how he can get them to this land, how we can transition kids. And to be called so 100% to something gets rid of all the distractions. And he has a clarity of focus and a clarity of call that really moved and touched me. Did I have any more pictures? Or no? Yeah, that's the last one for me. So I'll let Quindle talk.
Okay, the bug there is actually a female termite. It is that long. If you're to look at the other side of it, there is rings on it, and each ring represents a year. That is a female, like I said, is actually about 8 years old. There's these termite things on the ground there, and one of the workers that was there grabbed some kind of an axe thing, and he went in and started ripping them out. And what he was doing was going in and finding the king and the queen, and eliminate the king and the queen, and the rest of the colony would die. So, Charlie and Trofina. Charlie is James's youngest brother, and he spent the entire time with us there. It was a good thing. He was a good guy, and made us laugh, and he hurt himself on a motorcycle accident. We felt sorry for him for a little bit, but life goes on. James, all of us had different opportunities throughout the time there to either to sit in a group or a partial group setting and listen to him talk and share stories about Kenya, about his life. And some of us even had opportunity to do some one-on-one with him. And one of the occasions that I was one-on-one with him, we had just come into the property. We were kind of late in the day and everybody got out of the car. And the two of us just sat there and we talked for about an hour and a half. And I decided I wanted to talk on that conversation today because that particular conversation got down to his faith and what he believes and how he trusts God, like was already alluded to, trusting God for everything, having faith in God, that God knows what's best, God knows what he's doing, and to surrender to him completely. With that comes obedience. And that kind of tied into Mel's last sermon there, because Mel talked about obedience, and it was ironic that the whole service was on obedience, and so everything is kind of tied in. So yesterday, I finally decided that I would kind of focus on that conversation, but I couldn't remember everything. And Karina happened to be on a chat with James, so I took over her laptop for a bit. And I got on there, and so I decided what I'm going to do is, in order to represent James, I'll read you his words and let him speak. And that'll be better than me trying to remember. And it's kind of funny because it's almost been a month since we sat and talked at one time, and some of his answers are almost identical to what he had spoke about before. And that kind of says to me that, you know, there's a passage in Scripture which talks about being ready with an answer for everything when somebody asks you about your faith, okay? This kind of tells me that this guy does have an answer for why he does what he does and why he believes what he does. Bishop Nick has the same focus on his conversation when he talks about his dreams and everything. It's kind of the same thing, and he knows exactly what he's talking about because he believes in it. So I just had started asking him if he remembered the day we were in the car, and he said, yeah. And I said, you quoted a couple scriptures that spoke to you where God has brought you. Do you remember them? And he says, I can remember. I have more than one scripture about what context would you be looking at. His spelling is very good, but his grammar is not so. And there's one section I'll probably just skip over because I can't even understand what he's trying to say in it. I think the context of coming to rely on God for all things, learning to rely on God. Oh, yes. I have always had the book of Psalms, chapter 20, all of it. I've always had the book of John where I say that. So where it says that, relying on God. So Psalms 20, Psalms 28. I was going to read these, but it'll take too long to get into it. So his scripture that he uses, Psalms 20, Psalms 28, verses 6 and 7, John 16:33, 1 Thessalonians 5:24, some of his key scriptures where it talks about where he's at. Psalms 28, then John 16:33. I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. That is the word that has always kept me going through the toughest times of my life. I know that if that scripture is engraved in my spirit, then the same God who calls me more than a conqueror is capable to take me through anything. The other part we talked about, this is my question, the other part of when we talked about being obedient to what God has called us to do, I think you had something for that as well. And he references 1 Thessalonians 5:24 that reminds us on how God is faithful to make our dreams happen. I ask you this because I've been asked to talk about you and the heart that you have to follow what God has called you and true to do. I feel to help represent that scripture that guides you is the best way I can do that. He says, oh, great, please remember to mention this. That God has always reminded me in Trofina one thing, that God is faithful even at times when we are not. I will be quick to let you know one thing. There are times I could hit rock bottom and things all around me look all dead and collapsed. It is whenever I could completely surrender even my fears and doubts to God that I have been seeing him disprove my condition or not disapprove of his condition, but I guess my interpretation would be to excuse my condition by his overwhelming faithfulness. To me, God is simply a good father. Why do I say this? The last thing that was expected of me is that having grown up without the close care and love of a father, it could never be expected of me, of all people, to be able to be called father at this early stage. Who said God is not a miracle in his own nature, let alone his ways? So at a very early age, they lost their father, and they kind of grew up without a father. We talked a bit about because Nick had talked about helping the orphans and widows and God blessing and increasing. And it's actually, I couldn't find the exact scripture, but the thought is in that, and if you look in James, where James chapter 1, verse 27, he talks about true religion is this, and one of those things is to care for the orphans and the widows. And Nick was talking about this in that God blesses people to do that. So he was just, it was as a word of encouragement. It was like the first day we got there, like it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, and he was preaching at us, right? And he didn't waste any time. But it was good. A little bit late to be trying to comprehend everything. So I was asking him about that, and I said, doesn't mean as much to you as it does to him, as to Bishop Nick. And he said, I'd say yes, and I'd say no. Yes, for the simple fact that when I made up my mind to leave everything and serve these wonderful kids, God has never, ever failed me. I'd say no, because I've never wanted to think that I am doing a huge favor to God by helping the lives of these beautiful girls and boys. But I look at this as a great humbling privilege that God has chosen me. To take care of his own. To the no part, do some think that you're doing God a huge favor? And straight to the answer, he said yes. And I wish I could read you part of his answer, but this is where I didn't really understand what he's saying. And he kind of goes, I won't try and explain it because I don't understand it. But he talked a little bit about even people in the church where they would despise. He says, despise and avoid our company. There are times I had no single friend. We could only be seen as Trifina and I, the two of them, simply because we were looking like we had nothing better to do, and so we were spending time in the slums with homeless children. So I think they were being perceived as, we got nothing better to do with our lives, so we're just going to go hang out with a bunch of kids and not work. And so there was a bit of tension, I guess, going on there. And then I was in the middle of this conversation, and Chris called me, so I just said, hi from Chris. He just called me about tomorrow. Thanks, James. I know I could have asked you more. I have learned a lot and enjoyed the times we sat and talked one-on-one or as a group. I miss that. Also, the other guys miss that, and if it is rare to have that kind of time to visit one another. Here we are spread out during our work and life. We don't have the time to visit. Is there anything you want me to pass on tomorrow to the church or to the guys? And addressing the church, please let them know that it is never to be taken for granted that God has chosen Lakewood and given them a burden to be part of this great dream. What God has in store for our lives, your families, your works and ministry is beyond the perception of human eyes. So let's keep running with this dream. Tamani has gone beyond Trifina and I. So let's get this dream to a living reality. It is possible. Much love from the kids.
Thanks, Quindle. Well, like Quindle said, there's no way to really give a sense. And just sitting down talking with the guys, there's no way to get a real sense of what they experienced. But they did get a little bit of video of some of what they experienced. I want to invite Dave Rowland to come up and set up the video that we're going to see in just a moment, which kind of gives you a bit of a sense of the walk to Tamani.
Okay, I'm just going to share with you guys about a five-minute video, and as Quindle has mentioned before, it's missing a key element, and that's definitely the smell. But it'll give you a sense of what it was like to walk from New Hope Academy to the Tamani Orphanage. And it was interesting to me because it wasn't really what I expected, and I can only relate it back to my own personal experience. So when I was thinking, like slums, I was kind of trying to equate it to something like an East Van situation, but it wasn't like that at all. And what was interesting about it was that it was kind of entrepreneurship at its best. Everybody seemed to be running a business or trying to make some money in some way. And the people that were in the slums, you know, for the most part, they were, you know, they were fairly well dressed and fairly productive overall. Although their conditions were absolutely horrendous, which you'll get a sense of it through this video. So it was quite interesting, and we need to keep in mind too that these people aren't, like, they don't have programmings and assistance like we do in Canada, where they can tap into welfare and that sort of thing. So, you know, it really becomes a game of survival for them. So, you know, every day they need to make just enough money to make sure that they can have some food to eat and a bit of shelter over their head. So, anyways, this is just clips of the walk. It's 5 minutes. The walk from New Hope is about 10 minutes long. So you'll see us walking through the slums. I've got some video of us actually walking into Tamani, so you'll see the kids. And at the very end, I'm standing on the second balcony of Tamani, looking down. So you'll get a sense of the contrast between inside Tamani and outside in the slums. So you'll see the kids kind of banging on the Tamani doors trying to get in because they've seen us walking into the orphanage and they can hear us having fun and playing. So they want to get in there and get in on that action as well. So so go ahead, roll the video, and it'll be self-explanatory.
Tamani. go. They think that's funny. I think they're. What are you eating? What do you have today?
What is that you having?
Wow, that looks
rice.
Good.
Rice
and cabbage. Is it good?
Yes.
Yes, good.
Hey! Wally.
Striking to see the contrast between the two sides of the wall. That's just, thanks, Dave. One of the things, obviously, that you pick up in the video is that daily life's a little different in Kenya than in here. So, Albert, why don't you come up and share a little bit about what life was like as you guys experienced it there.
The video, you know, shows the slum area, and Nairobi has some of the largest slums in the world. I think actually the largest slums in the world, and we just, you know, touched the surface on that. But going on into everyday life, Kenya has, you know, a broad area. They have wealthy people, they have middle class, but they have a huge, huge low income population, and that's kind of. Most of my slides will kind of show that too, and that's the reality too. When we were there, you realize that people are just even when they're out of the slums, they're just surviving. They're earning $5-6 a day, $100-200 a month, and you know, when I was kind of aware of that sort of thing, and I thought, well, yeah. That's all right, but because everything is priced accordingly. But when you go there and you realize that, you know, for gas they're paying $1.50 a liter, and for when we went to the grocery store, which most Kenyans, at least in the lower income, wouldn't be able to do that. But we went, and a bottle of water, you know, was $1, and chocolate bars are $1, and coffee is $4 a pound. And then you think, well, geez, these guys are making $100 a month. How are they surviving? So, you know, they obviously do. As Dave said before, they don't have the social programs. So that was kind of something that really spoke to me when we were there. So I'm just going to run through a quick pictures, and then we'll see. You probably saw this one already. This is basically the orphanage in Tamani. That's their dining area. Before we went to Kenya, I went to YouTube, and I found an early video that Dave Sakobi had done of the orphanage, and they were at about 8-10 kids, and I think they're up around 30 now. They just expanded the second floor, which Dave had done some video from the second floor, and that was just done before we got there, and the orphanage is growing, so... And this is the second floor that they've done now, and this is where the girls sleep. There's a separate space for the boys now, smaller because they only have about five or six boys. Typical where we were again, it was kind of an industrial area. Lots of people moving to Nairobi from the rural areas. in search of jobs, which is kind of funny because when we went to Isinia, we and people living on the land, really it seemed like they had better opportunities if they would stay where they were, farming and subsistence. But I think they see the lure of moving to the big city. And so there's lots and lots of construction going on. The construction and the roads and that is not keeping up with the amount of people coming in. And this is the sort of thing that you see. This is not in front of the guest house, but the road in front of the guest house was almost identical to something like this. And as Dave mentioned, everybody's an entrepreneur. So here's your tire shop. I don't know where they got them. I don't know if you could find a pair to match, but this is the tire shop. Typical supermarket. This is in Insignia, where the new orphanage is going to be located. The orphanage is actually out into the country. It's about 10 kilometers from town, but every day on the way out there, we would drive by this, and there's a supermarket and a butcher shop. And the other thing was really cool, we did not see... You know, the whole time we were there, I can think of one time where we saw somebody begging. No people on the street with their hands out. Everybody's, you know, trying to make a living honestly. These guys were loading up the cement. Labor is so cheap that that's how you do it. You do it by hand. This is the kitchen at the current orphanage. That's the extent of their supplies. Now, they do have a little storehouse where they do have bags of maize and some vegetables and so on. But this is their cooking kitchen for 30 kids. And this is a shot from the new land there. And just some shots from these drafts came actually right up to where we were working, very like, you know, within. We actually ran after them and chased them. So, clean water. I'll leave it to you to define clean. But this was also common. Water was delivered very frequently. They do have the well out there now, but they don't have a pump. They don't have power out there, so still relying on having water delivered. And that's where we're just getting started on the fence, making a little bit of progress. And at the end of the week, or end of the 2 weeks, we're just finishing up. And that's from the site. So, yeah, I think that's, daily life is definitely different for them. Even in the video, the eating the rice and the cabbage, it was a big deal for them. Our meals, even though we ate at a hotel when we were out there, very simple. Stewed meat, rice, stewed meat, rice. So, yeah. So, and spinach and cabbage. Yeah. So, that's about it.
And I heard you guys are really hankering for some goat. Am I right? Everyone's looking forward to getting a little more goat in their diet. Okay. Yeah. So, Bob, why don't you come up and share a little bit about some of the people you met? And it was touched on by Quindle and Chris a little bit, but maybe you'll share a little bit more about some of the significant people you met along the way.
Well, most of the people that met along the way, they've been covered. So I'm just going to go a little bit different. Going to Kenya, I had the idea in my head that I'm going to go there to make a difference. And most of the people that I met made a difference in my life. Just by the way that they live their life, the faith that they have in God, every morning they wake up to the time they go to bed. They completely rest. With waking up in the morning, God will provide every day. And for me, the faith that they had just pushed me to be a better person, make me want to push myself with my faith, become a better Christian, father, person in general. So the people, they've already been mentioned. So that's pretty much it.
All right. Well, one of the significant pieces, obviously, when you guys first got there, and we saw it just at the end of the walk to Tamani, was being able to see the guys with the kids. And we wanted to have Noah and James come and share a little bit about your experience hanging out with the kids at Tamani.
So just before we get started talking about this, I wanted to clarify a couple things. So Charlie, with the motorcycle, just kind of burned his leg a little bit on the exhaust. It wasn't serious at all. just to clarify. I got to spend a lot of time with Charlie because he was my age, and so we clicked. And it was cool getting insights into what Kenya life was and what the culture was there. And one of the things that struck me was, like my dad said, there is like high-end, like rich people, and there's a lot of poor people. And where the rich neighborhoods are, there's also slums, because they're the people that work in their homes. And it was just kind of interesting that the two would go together like that. And so James is going to start off.
Sure. yeah, it was just amazing being there. Like, all the kids totally touched everybody's heart. And as you can see, all the kids have beautiful smiles on their faces, and it was quite amazing because everything's so simple, yet everything's so happy. It's not like when you've seen in the little cafeteria room thing. It's not like you've seen a big TV there and they just got done playing a video game or anything else. Like, their games consisted of dancing around, making up songs, and doing it as a big group. And it was just amazing to see. Like I said, like, each one of us were touched deeply by the kids and everything that they did. And
okay. So we visited the orphanage a couple times. The first time we saw a lot of their games. They definitely played a lot of the games that the youth taught them. I could start to tell some of them. The second time we went, we brought balloons and a couple games. We brought a couple games. And so we were playing with the balloons, and they were quite enthusiastic about it. It was kind of cool. And it started with a game of Keep It Up and quickly turned into a game of beat each other with balloons. there was a picture of James earlier, or of John earlier, with the balloon going at it. And yeah, it struck me that how happy they were and how much of a family they were. A lot of the times here, especially, you see like the older kids kind of exclude the little kids because they don't want to play with them or whatever, right? And a lot of the times here, you'd see them going in a big circle and like they'd open up and scoop the little ones in, right? And it was cool to see how much of a family they were that way. This is the first time we visited Tamani. This is the first image we saw. And the sign says, "Our Father's welcome home." And it was just very touching that that was there. Like, we walked through the slums, right? We had no idea what to expect. It was just so depressing, and seeing the reality and then walking into here and seeing it clean and safe and the sign, and they were all excited to see us. It was cool. And so the last time we came, we had made a piñata, and we set it up, and they had never seen a piñata before, and they didn't know what was inside it. And but yeah, they got into the beating it pretty quick. we were quite impressed with the piñata. It lasted all 30 kids, and the top two spheres burst open, but the bottom was secure, and so they'd hit it, and the candy would fly out the side just a little bit, and so every kid got a little bit of candy. And it was cool watching them because they, especially when it finally went and there was candy and their mad scramble, and they weren't hoarding it. They would give it. They were sharing it. And it was, I don't know, that it was just something I wasn't expecting. And yeah, they had a lot of the clapping games and songs and games like that that didn't have a lot of, like, because they had a couple balls, but they didn't have many toys like that at all. And one thing we learned very quickly, that they like hugs. They like lots of hugs. when we got there, when we left. The first time we were there, we kind of shook their hands awkwardly, but then by the second time, we were just like hugs everywhere. It was awesome.
Yeah, you can see that, yeah, each one of us, like, with their smiles and their eyes full of brightness and life. That, and, yeah, it's just amazing. And they're all itching for hugs because, well, that's what they really want the most. And, yeah, and this is one of the neighbor's kids when we were out there working, getting the fence up. And it was pretty amazing, like, even... He was like, he didn't have like a big transformer toy. His toys were like two simple toys. One was an old tire, and he'd get rolling it around, and then he'd just watch it go over the bumps and try to keep up with it and the simplicity of it, and just always smiling too. And that was all his clothes that he had on like the whole time. And as you can see, like the area is just going to be beautiful. So when the orphanage do get out in that area. Well, that's going to be the kids they're going to be playing with. And his other toy that he had, what he ended up doing after a few days was collecting some of the wire that were cutting from the fence, and he'd make a steering wheel out of the metal. And then he'd take the other piece of the wire, and then run it down on a stick. And he'd get two ends of lids, and he'd drive it around. And he's, like, giving it down the trail, and he's, ooh, and he's just smiling the whole time. It was amazing. And he'd hit little bumps, woo. It was just, and you just wonder, like, you just get back to what makes you happy. And with all the kids, you just seen it. They were totally content, and without all the fancy, you know, video games and everything else. So it does make you realize how great life is with simple things.
One of the cool things we were asking about, his name was Saruni, and asking about that stuff and whether he goes to school. And I guess the nearest school is a couple hours walk away. And so so he doesn't go. And so that's one of the exciting things, was that with the Promised Land, they're hoping to build not only the orphanage and like the residence for the girls and stuff, but also a school for the kids in the area. And the neighbors were excited. We had the neighbors stop by and talk to us about it, right? And so it's cool, and the whole area is excited. So the last thing I want to talk about, before we left, we did the Coins for Kenya, and we gathered coins and everything. And so you had seen pictures of this, their sleeping area, and they have little foam mattresses, and the ones they had were getting quite worn out because they've had them since they started. I think it was 8 years ago, and they were just the foam pads and stuff. So one of the things that we did while we were there, we did some mattress shopping, and with the coins that we collected, we got 40 of them to replace all the ones in the orphanage. And he said these were some the better quality ones, and they should last another 10 years pretty easily. So it was exciting, and so thank you for that. Oh, and we also got mosquito nets for all the kids too to hang over their beds. So, yeah.
Thanks, guys, so much. One other piece that has been mentioned briefly is their experience at church, and I saw a couple of the guys up here wanting to do a little more clapping and dancing this morning while we were singing. I saw you guys. I was watching you a little bit, and I saw I wanted to go a little more. So Mel's here to talk a little bit about their experience at New Hope Church.
Up here a little bit shaking in that whole area when you're looking at the church. And when you're talking about the church experience, the New Hope Church, it goes back to even before we left, because it was thrown at us that, and I remember that the date when Chris said, oh yeah, they're expecting us to preach the two Sunday mornings. And in my heart, God's telling me, that's you. And in my body, it was like, no, it's not me. And, but I was seeking that. And the whole time it kept coming up. Obedience is what kept coming back to me for what I was supposed to speak on. And when we get there, to be in there and experience a church, this is, in the Sean course, we learned about Apostle Creed, and the one statement is there is a universal church. And that's the reality that became so in my face there, is the universal church that it doesn't matter where we are, we serve the same great, mighty God that is out there, that we serve him here, they serve him there. It became so real. And when you look at what God is speaking to me in obedience, it's funny how Chris, we showed up Saturday morning, or Sunday morning, about 1 o'clock we got there. Chris spoke that Sunday morning. And I was very thankful that it wasn't me that Sunday morning. But yes and no, because I was sweating in that whole next week and I couldn't really. But halfway through they said, oh, they got the women's group there and they're going to take over the service. So you don't have to worry about it inside. I'm going, yes. But I had that wrestle of, but God's been speaking to me on this. And it came back at about Thursday or Friday. Bishop Nick said, no, the lady actually, or the woman in charge actually wants to hear you speak. And I'm going, it is real. God has a message. And in that church service, the speaking was still very white because it was Chris and I, what we had experienced here. But just the praising God was just an experience to behold. We do have, at the end, you'll see a video just of Trofina leading worship service. It's just off a video phone camera. It's not that great, but it gives you an experience of what that is. But we serve a mighty God who goes way before us in whatever we do. It's just up to us to have that obedience to follow his push. That service lasted, I'm going to say, 3 hours, 3.5 hours was that service. And the whole way through this, I learned a very valuable thing. Don't drink 2 bottles of water when you have to speak. But the whole thing of obedience, a number of the verses that I used that I had planned for the sermon were used through 3 different people, 3 separate contexts, were verses that I got, that God had given to me and what I had spoke on. And so it's just that obedience of pushing where God is, or going where God is pushing you to go. Part of that whole experience too is soaking it in. We have our way of doing things here. They have their way of doing things here. It's all serving the same God. Another part of that universal church that I want to speak on that I was just thinking about here this morning is when we were at the orphanage the last day. This is very, very moving, if you could just experience this. The last day, just before we were getting ready to leave, we all gathered around and held hands, the kids, us, and we had a prayer. We just prayed together, and you think these are kids, and the depth of their prayers and the verses that they just spilled out from them was just, it was very moving, very real for us. This is who they are. This is, God is their hope. They live by that, and they have to. And it moved me in a way that says, you know, I got to put myself out there to be used by God and see what God is using, not going at what God is moving in and chicken out and fall back on my own abilities, I guess, put it that way. So that was, the universal church became very real. The singing was very African. The speaking, half of the speaking was very white, and the other half, or Canadian, the other half was, I'd never spoken in tongues before I got there, so that was, you know, that was very interesting that way. But is the video next? One thing you have to understand is the floor here is dirt, is gravel. So as we're done this worship time, there's a dust rising within the service. Here's Chris following, but he forgot. The universal church, the experience of this is like was mentioned before, the evangelists that come in. We're sitting there, I'm going to say, I don't even know what time it started, 6 o'clock in the morning, was that when the practicing? 6 o'clock in the morning, doors and windows are not, they're not airproof, it's not necessary there, but we could hear the worship services happening within, everywhere around us, starting at 6:30 in the morning, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they're still going. You can hear the music and the pastors, and they're going, like, to look at the reality, these people are revved up for hours, and it was very real. You're walking through the slums, there's churches, what to say, churches everywhere you look, little signs here and there. Not all maybe on the right path, but there is. It's everywhere you're going, so, yeah.
Thanks a lot, Mel. So really, with no dust here, we have no excuse. Just saying.
Just want to interject that song. I don't know if you heard the words she's singing. As God is good, he's very good. And during that service, she said, everybody should have their hands up and just start yelling the things that God is good for. What has God done for you? And she said she didn't want to hear a silent person in the church. So all of us were, she said we did admirably. We did well. So
that's awesome. One of the cool things is just to see. I love seeing you guys all hanging out together. And I hear floor hockey's been a little more entertaining since you guys got back too. Bob was saying you guys are getting a little rougher with each other. But seeing how this team came together, because I'm just gonna be honest with you guys. This is just sort of just my perception. If we would have had a choice just to kind of put together a team, you know, of just kind of whatever before we started this whole project, I don't know if this would have been the team that would have come together. And I don't say that to disrespect any of you guys, but it's just a statement of how amazing our God is to put together exactly the right team that goes way beyond the plans that I would probably have or the people that I would probably think of maybe just to put together a team. But God had something so good in mind. And so we want to talk a little bit about how the team actually came together. And Jason, you're going to come up and speak to that, just talking about what the experience was like for the team.
Good morning, and I'll try to hold my notes and this all at the same time this way. There we are. I am going to talk about how the team came together. I might even embarrass some of the guys at the front. You won't see them if they're blushing since they're at the front. Because I'll talk about how a team came together for success and even some love for each other, which made everything happen. I think of the story, really the phrase from Cain and Abel about my brother's keeper. And really, that's what we became really fast, that we were my brother's keepers. We were looking after each other. We were, what's the phrase, brothers from another mother. Maybe other mothers. You heard of that. But there we are getting ready to go. And I can tell you, I felt this. I bet they will agree. But even before we got to Nairobi, probably something happened on the flight from Vancouver to London that we were all suddenly a team. And we walked for a dinner. And remember, we were still on home time, so this was really walking for breakfast. But we sucked it up. We had dinner. We were moving like a single-celled organism, right, all together, with purpose. We were, which is very impressive. Here we are in our finest. And to bring in the concept of love, I think about Jesus said that all people will know that you're mine, you're with me, when you act as disciples and love each other. And that's really what this team did. So I'm going to talk for a few moments about what a day was like for us, a typical day, mostly in Assinia. And I'm going to again embarrass them, a few of them, with some stories. But you know that men understand this, maybe women don't, that the more we make fun of each other as men, that's actually like hugs and kisses. And even if you really get burned, oh, that was just a terrible slight and offense. That's not bullying or teasing to men, is it? No, we're good. Let's see. I mean, Noah, every day would remind us what? What did you remind us to do, Noah? Shout it out. Malarone. Take the Malarone. Friendly, because the rest of us would forget, right? And then we would have got awfully sick. Craig was a tireless advocate for getting us proper toast. If we were hungry, Crease, as he was called, would climb trees to find us berries we weren't sure whether we should eat or not. Right? And how many times would we all go back, even as a group when we didn't have to pick up yet more pieces of luggage? And particularly for the man we called Jim Solo, who had to go days without clean shirts, and we all just put up with it. Yeah, we did. That's part of being a team. What did a day look like? We'd wake up in the hotel. No, that wasn't our hotel. It could have been worse. All around 6 a.m. in the morning out at Assinia preparing for a day at the Promised Land, I know I would was one of my tasks to wake up the man we call the milkman, James Brady, a 6:30 a.m. wake-up call, so I would knock on his door and he wouldn't wake up. He'd never hear it, right? But it would probably wake up everybody else, right? Yeah, they'd hear it. There's my room there. It looks better from afar than when you're actually there. That looks all right, hey? Yeah? Princess bed. Okay. I had the honeymoon suite. We would amble up there. If you looked at the path to the left, it goes to the place where we'd have breakfast. It really wasn't breakfast. Maybe Chris would amble in after some sort of sleepwalking safari in the night. What else? The white rhino would regale us with stories of encounters with phantom baboons. Yeah, guys would be fighting for something called jam and butter. The coffee that wasn't coffee. And we'd talk and have breakfast, and really we'd prepare for the day, right? And figure out what we were going to do at the Promised Land. That also included trying to figure out how to get there, right? And that included Dave bathing us in Purell so we'd be safe. And I don't know. Is this starting to hurt you guys? No. We are preparing for the challenges, really, of the Promised Land and the work that we had to do there. So you see that and you think, we got to put something there. And you know what? We actually caught a break from God in terms of our team. We didn't build bricks. Remember all those videos we showed you about building bricks? We didn't do any bricks. We caught a break in that we were doing a chain link fence, but God wasn't going to make it easy for us. He was going to, in terms of staying together as a team, stuff wasn't ready. I mean, the holes we had to dig were significant. And to put those posts in it were significantly, you see that post there? I don't know. I'm not a technical guy. It's concrete post, right? First, we tried two guys lifting them around. That was too heavy. Then three, then four, then five guys trying to grunt around. Eventually, we dragged them behind a bus. Don't tell anybody. It would have been awfully tiring. We had those challenges. And then again with the holes, it hadn't rained since December 22nd or December 23rd. To call it dirt is not really accurate. It's more like rock because it's so hard. And then, you know, we didn't want to go to Kenya and be a bunch of Mzungus, the white guys there, just doing things our ways. We didn't have jackhammers and explosives and heavy equipment, even though we could have used it. We did the work like Kenyans. James and I took 1 hour and a half one time just to dig a hole another about 6 inches deep, right? He had a bent piece of rebar, really, to try to loosen it up, and I had a soup ladle. I'm on my stomach digging it out, right? So he's got the blisters on his hands, and the grass is so hard there. I'm on my stomach, and it pokes you like hypodermic needles. And at the end of the day, you lift your shirt up, and it's just a covered... Oops, I hit the thing there. You're just covered in little holes. So we still had those challenges. And do you think as a team we'd let that get us down? Everybody say, no! They brought us together even more. There were no problems. Oh, apart from the tools, right. There's Craig, and it looks like Two Steps. He's got another nickname there. That's the Home Depot they're at, getting some equipment. Right? After a long day, I mean, no problem, right? Getting back. That's not a stage photo, is it? We're pushing a bus. Okay, it's about 9, 10, I don't know what it is, 11:30 at night in Maasai land. It's kind of scary. Where are we? In the middle of nowhere, right? And there's Craig and Quindle under the bus fixing it, right? We haven't had dinner yet either. Haven't eaten in hours. So, I mean, those challenges to come together as a team. And then back to the hotel that's not really a hotel for dinner that's not really a dinner, right? Yeah. And there it is, hanging there. And you can't see the cats jumping in and out for the scraps and such. It's not refrigerated, is it, guys? No. And after a long day, stressful work, tiring work in the hot sun, there you go. Can I tell you one of the best lines from our trip? It was Dave, right? Yeah, they know. After a challenging day trying to get back with transportation, what did Dave say that we had to look forward to? A cold shower and diarrhea dinner. Forgive me. Right. You know, there's Chris eating a termite, and there's a picture of our usual lunch there. It's a little small, but the green stuff everybody asks, the light green, is potatoes, mashed potatoes colored with pumpkin leaves. And there's corn. It's not really corn in there. It's more like little pea gravel, you'd say. Yeah. It doesn't digest. So it's called recycling. You probably had it for lunch the next day. So. You know, but after a day, we would still be with each other, hanging out as a team. We didn't go off to our rooms and hide. We'd share. We'd have that meal that wasn't really a meal together, devotions. One night it even turned into testimonies, which is, you know, something I wasn't prepared for, but you know, I wound up sharing about my own personal family as a kid growing up and really the lack of a family, substance abuse problems and such, and thinking, hey, now we got a family here. Like, our team is not just guys doing a bunch of work. Guys can do work, right? What we were a family, too, in this team, and that's a contributing factor to our success. I mean, we are sharing everything. I was just thinking we shared granola bars, right? Water. What else? Beef jerky was going around. Imodium. I gotta say, we could walk blindfold there and know who it was by the noises they were making. Not out of their mouths. At one point, somebody came up to me from the team and says, I don't know, Jason, how you'll feel, if you'll feel comfortable about this, if it's you're a little out of your element, but can I use your deodorant? Sure. Never. Yeah. Armpits are armpits, right? I mean, that's teamwork. That's getting it together. That is the team. In Assinia, some of us weren't all together. I actually had, you know, this my own accommodations there, and this is the Spartan. No, I mean, it's a luxury bathroom. But word got out that it worked. I mean, you can see that you can use the toilet and the shower at the same time, which saves a lot of time if any of you have trouble getting ready in the morning. But my shower, where you see the little thing there, it didn't send out lightning bolts of electric sparks. So even though, you know, I actually felt lonely a bit having my own room because we're so together so much. I mean, you kind of miss that at the end of the day when you go to sleep, miss being with the guys. But when word got out somehow that my shower kind of worked. Now, this maybe sounds wrong or bad, but I enjoyed the steady stream of guys coming in for shower. Right? Does that sound wrong? Right. If you could zoom, look, and you can see the sink, the tap there is not pointing into the tap, into the basin, and then it's not connected at the bottom, so if you turn that on, the water just runs onto the floor. And the toilet seat there isn't actually attached. You just kind of hope you don't slide off. And you know, we even, I think when we talk about this, we sometimes have challenges even when you come back, because you're with each other so much as a team, and all of a sudden you're not, right? And you're this family, you're separate. And I know some of us felt, well, we may have got emails to each other after the trip, kind of pep you up a bit. I think someone said, yeah, we got this connection, we're a team. And that's all part of building the success we had. Also part of the success is our leader, Chris. And we can't finish the service today without recognizing him, because we saw all he did for us. We didn't see all the stuff he did behind the scenes. Chris, I think he feels like he wished he could go back and get one more souvenir. and that was a Kenyan national soccer jersey. So our team is going to secure one for them as their appreciation. Alas, it wasn't just as easy as going online. It's kind of an obscure soccer jersey. We may have to send one of us back over there to get it and bring it back. But we're really thankful for Chris, and so should all of you, you know, recognize his leadership. You know, thanks, Chris. We're going to get you that jersey by the end of the year. But no wonder we all had success because of this teamwork. You know, we had success for the fence, and we were even nervous that that would happen. But big surprise. Why should we be surprised? We all worked together like a team. It was going to happen no matter the obstacles. Right? Those holes could have been not dug at all. We would have just got it done. You know, no wonder they were success. You even noticed that the Kenyan people were awed, were impressed by how well we worked together and got things done. The saying is Kenya time, and things don't get started until 2 o'clock, but by 2 o'clock you should see all that we got done together. I mean, if we put Canada and most industrial states' productivity levels to shame. And no wonder that all of us probably still want to go back. I know if we had plane tickets booked for tomorrow, we'd be rushing out of here packing our bags, even if we weren't sure what we'd do when we get there. We'd all want to go back as a team, some kind of reunification. So no wonder, you know, bigger picture, how this all worked is because we were, you know, Jesus' disciples. At every time when we talked to each other, when we looked at each other, when we interacted, when we were working, you know, not for ourselves, working through God, right? And that's really how it all happened. And again, I think, I don't even be surprised. Why should we be surprised that such amazing things happen when we all look at it that way, when we have that single-minded purpose? Brothers, keepers, disciples, also Christian men. But I have to add to this, real men too, right? Yeah, come on. Real men, right? Grunting and groaning and making noises. And suffering through a lot of the hardships. And then I think my last point is we never forgot whom we were representing. And I mean God, but I also mean all of you. And to think that this church has raised all this money and sent two teams there in such a short a time to do this amazing work is not just because of us who are really there on your behalf, but because of all of you, right? So I know all of us. On behalf of the team, I think. Every one of you from the back in the cheap seats to the more pricey ones in the front, thank you.
Thanks, Jason. Now, just for the all the nicknames you may have missed along the way that Jason kind of alluded to a number of times, you can always go back on Lakewood Goes to Kenya because there was a post actually specifically about nicknames on there. All right, a couple more guys to come up and share a little bit. Jim, come up and talk to us a little bit about the project because we did actually send you guys over with a purpose other than just experiencing noises and interesting food. So tell us a little bit about what happened with the wall.
Well, I think one thing that's struck me over all this is how whole Tamani has been a series of small steps, and you know none of them seem very, very big in themselves, but they're all leading to something. And this trip was just one of our steps. I think probably the first step was our first experience with Kenyan time. We were supposed to go to the ostrich farm, but then Pastor Nick got a phone call that, well, the truck's going to go to the quarry and pick up the posts and take them out to the land. So we all went to the quarry to wait for this truck to load it up. And we waited. That's the quarry truck. We got to see a lot of that. I think we were there about 2 hours. So I think we've... Four, okay. Yeah, see, I didn't have my watch with me. But anyway... I think we've all got that truck memorized, and I want one.
There was two.
Well, this was the better one.
The other one had doors.
Hey. Okay, this is out of the land. This is actually during one of our lunch times. That's when we still had the bus running. The hotel would send a truck or a car. Sometimes the water shock out with our lunch, and you know we'd break for lunch, when the car showed up, and I have no idea what time that usually was. Like I said, I didn't have my watch with us. But anyway, when the truck came, that's when lunch was. That you can see the well in the front there. It doesn't show up too well, but you can see that there's green vegetation where they were just dumping the water out. So you know, you throw some water at that land, and it greens up, it blossoms. Okay, next one. That's the very beginning. Once again, small steps again. You can see the holes were dug there before we got there. It was only later that we found out that some of them had to be deepened. But once again, it was a step. You know, we figured out which holes were deep enough, and so we put in the posts and which ones needed digging, and we dug them. And after a while, we had a process going. A couple of guys would be setting posts in concrete. A couple of us would be digging holes. There was no 2x4 around, so I couldn't carry that, so I had to work. And that's further on the process. You can see some of the posts are still leaning over. They haven't been concreted yet. But we were making progress. Next one. And there you can see some of the posts are straight up. We might even have some fabric on there by then. And that's the east side of the land. We've got fabric up on the fence, and that's one of the neighboring families just coming by for a visit. And part of the work was making the piñata for the kids, and Albert was working on that one day, and you can see that we've got that portion of the fence pretty much done. Both sides were done by the time we left. Posts were all set in the back, and James and company finished off the fabric after we'd gone. So that step of the project is done. They've got the boundaries defined, even though it's not a secure site then yet. And there's still lots more to be done out there, and I hope I have the opportunity to be out there again.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Jim. Now, just to get this right, Chris, the length you guys were walking the property, oh, I skipped ahead, sorry. The length you guys were walking the property to haul those posts and the concrete down was how far?
Well, the length of fencing was just over 900 feet, but the property's
1,000 feet long. So you guys were hauling stuff all the way, yeah. All the way down there and back and down there and back and yeah. All right. Well, we want to kind of move from where Tamani's at right now and the project that was done to where things are going. And so, Craig, why don't you come up to share a little bit about the hopes and dreams and the vision for what's next and what you guys picked up from your time there.
Sure. Thanks, Dave. So as you can see, it doesn't look like there's still very much there. So the biggest priority is to take the rest of these machine blocks and complete the front portion of the wall. We had most of the materials there, and the biggest reason why it needs to be completed as soon as we can is recently they started to disappear. Just randomly the blocks started to grow legs and walk away. So they've since put them all in that sea can, and the reason for that is that that we didn't have enough money to buy the concrete and the last of the machine blocks to complete the wall. So until that happens, then the blocks are at least safe inside the sea can. So what's left to do there is to buy some more machine stones, the sand, water, concrete, transportation, labor, all the rest of that kind of stuff that goes with it, and an iron gate that will actually contain the entire piece of property so people aren't just randomly wandering through and collecting whatever they need. Recently, we talked to James. He said that there's been some attempts to actually remove the wire that we did put up, and it was starting to grow legs. So he's been going back and forth out there pretty much every day just to make sure that there's a presence, that everybody knows that that it's still somebody there and it hasn't been abandoned and all that kind of thing. So Yeah, that's their biggest priority to begin with, just to stop that. The next biggest thing would be that foundation would be to have a building there. The intent is to develop the building as a reception area eventually, but in the immediate term would be to have someone living there as a watchman, just to make sure that the thievery and that kind of stuff just doesn't happen all the time. And with the price of labor, it's probably cheaper to have someone there every day, all day, versus having James drive back and forth in fuel from Nairobi anyways. So next biggest priority. To do that, he's going to need some water. So water pump system, pressure system, that kind of stuff that would go with the well that's been drilled. So they need a generator, generator pump system, tanks, that kind of stuff that will establish water supply. excuse me. Yeah, so then the next buildings that will take place will be for the kids and the people that will look after the kids and some of the other girls that help with the infants and that kind of stuff. So once there's some buildings set up for them to live in, there's water, their plans are to move the kids there as soon as they can. And long term, they'll have school. They've got teachers that have already suggested that they want to come and they want to work there, stay there, and be a part of that family. And then there would be some sort of a medical clinic there as well, just to meet their immediate needs and the needs for the people and the families around them. They've had neighbors that have come to them. You know, the fence isn't even there. It's a piece of dirt, and they've had neighbors come to them and say, "Can we bring our kids to your school?" You know, and they want to do it, like register for the school. Well, the school isn't going to exist for a significant period of time. And these people are, you know, it's their future. They look at it like some of the guys were saying earlier, that it's, you know, hours to walk to school. And we saw lots of the kids that were doing that. Like, I mean, they weren't getting home until, you know, around the time when we were leaving, lots of times 7:30 at night, and you'd see kids in uniforms walking out of the brush that, you know, there's hyenas, lions, all the different types of predators that exist in Africa live there. So these kids are going a long ways to get an education. They're definitely earning it. The next biggest potential they have with the property is to develop their own food supply. The soil is very rich. Probably 3/4 of the 10 acres is very growable. Once they have water, that well where they pumped the well down and developed the well, there was the flow from the rig had flown down the hill to a dugout, and they had actually, all the locals had dug a partial trench to make sure the water was focused, and it actually flowed right to their dugout. But the everything that the water came even close to, it was just like a big green funnel right to their dugout. So if you can get water to it, it'll grow. And with that amount of property, excuse me, they should be able to develop and grow enough food to support themselves, you know, for the bare essentials at the very least. So we've talked about what another team would do and that kind of thing, and really the biggest conclusion we came to, or at least everybody that I've talked to, is it's a very much a relationship building exercise. Their needs are very financial. How James and True manage their lives is just truly amazing. There isn't a way to describe it, because of the sense that we have. You know, when you have money here, you budget it, you do this money's for that, this is for that. They don't have money really at all. So the money that they get goes to the biggest need, and not all, never all of it, but the biggest need that they have at any given second. So it was very difficult for us to try and manage the funds that we had for the team, because every time we went to pay for something, well, this had to be paid for so that you could do this and this and this and still keep everything moving. So it was very much a challenge to do that, but it's also just amazing that God truly supplied everything that they needed at all times. It's just, and their whole world is there. They stay there, eat there. Everything is done away from the rest of the kids. So they very much miss each other as they're gone and that kind of thing. But right now they're going to have in the short term another 3 or 4 more. We supported Sarah to go to school while we were there, and this is Sarah now. So they basically when we got there, they had the money for transportation to get her to the school, but not for the tuition. So they were just seriously didn't know what they were going to do up until the morning, or I guess the night before she was leaving. And when we found that out, we all got together and put together some money so she could start. We paid, I believe, her first and second term tuition. So it gives her that to go forward, and just unbelievably happy, appreciative. It's a real blessing to be able to help them. So while we're there, one of the other things we discussed while we were there, the New Hope Church, or the academy where we were staying, is actually quite a large house for what we saw of their houses. It's probably, I don't know, like 1,200 or 1,500 square feet on the main floor, 2 stories. We talked about maybe the opportunity where, you know, what's a house worth? You know, it's within 2 blocks of the property, and you know, what's the potential of buying this house, moving the kids in here in term while the property is developed? As we found out, that it's quite cost prohibitive. The money that it would cost is probably approaching the development cost that it would to fully finish the promised land. So it became more of an issue. But we discussed maybe even renting, you know, because the two are very tied. The New Hope Church and Tammany are very much linked, but it would be potentially an option to rent the house, or support the rent in the house, and maybe split that as an option. And that's something I talked to James with last week, actually. The New Hope Church is very much not what I expected. While we were here, I always kind of questioned in my mind, how come, you know, as a congregation, they're not supporting, or what they're, you know, or how are they supporting Tammany? And it really didn't, until we got there, and it didn't really register. These people are living on the edge, and most of them come from the slums. So they're very much in the same state as, or state of need, anyways, as the kids and everybody else. And they do support each other. Nick was telling us one story about one of their pastors that had actually personally financed a bunch of the building of the actual church. He had taken the loan out in his name because the church can't get funding in any of their banks. He had taken out this loan in his name, and the church had basically paid it just as a conduit through him. So there's very much a family attitude on everything that we saw that they do. With that, I've got lots of numbers, lots of information. We're looking at putting together some sort of a foundation or nonprofit or charitable organization separate from the church to ensure that there isn't any questionability around the charitable giving and that kind of stuff. And we don't want to threaten the status or anything of the church. So if we can go down that path and set up a receivable foundation, I think it's a good alternative to maybe look at some corporate dollars and that kind of stuff to support them and move them down the road a little quicker if we can.
For you, Greg.
I'm just going to just ask you to stay up for one more minute here. And one of the other things that, just quickly to finish off here with our time with the guys, you know, in sitting down with these guys, kind of just to start a debriefing process with them, one of the things that stuck out to me was just the impact that this trip had had on each of them. And I know each of them could tell you their own stories, and I hope you'll take time to actually talk with them about some of those stories. But Craig, I'm just going to pick on you because you're up here already. If you would just share a little bit about how God has used this trip, not just how he did impact you, but how he is impacting you even now.
Okay. it felt to me while we were there, just through different times, God was just tearing my heart apart. It's very hard to see these kids where they're at and where they can be, and the only obstacle is money. But I'm sure God has a plan for that. In my life, he reached into my heart and my guts and just went, shook it all up and set me back down and said, well, do better. And and since we've come back, that's the road that I'm trying to follow in everything I'm doing. And it's really hard to get back to work. Everything we do now is touched some other way. It's tough. But God has very much given me a different perspective on my life. I was very much goal-oriented with work, driven very hard. And a lot of my own family stuff was still very much there in my world, but it became very much a routine. And that's something I very much seek to change.
Thanks a lot, Greg. And thanks to all the guys for sharing their heart with us today.